Let's do it.
To the right, 5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches
look at
it.
This.
Demole Williams, touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
Podcast. My name is Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. As always, joined tonight by my man QB1, JR. What's going on, JR?
It's been a rough few days, man. I'm going to make it, though, man.
Okay. We'll see how far you make it after you talk to the next man we got on here, Mr. Miles Gorham. What's going on, man?
What's going on? I mean, you got the finals. You got Team Lightskin taking it, holding it down 2-0. You got the Nashville Predators holding it down 3-1 against Pitt right now. So let's go.
Okay. Mr. Sexy Prince, what's going on with you, man? You make it home safely today?
I did. It was a good day. Actually, it was my day off, so I didn't have to worry about going anywhere and whatnot.
Okay. You still got a job, though? You still got a job?
I still have a job. I don't know how, but
you can't
I still
get fired on your day off, though, you know?
Random question of the day, y'all. The age, and if you can remember who, did y'all have your very first kiss?
Remember?
I'll start. Here's a quick story. I was 4 years old, and we had, you know, growing up Nigerian, you always have these Nigerian functions, so you meet a bunch of people. But we had family friends, right? And we had the family friend had everybody. They had four kids, but three of them were the same ages as my brothers. And one of them, Cleo, you know, I've been eyeing her for a little bit at the age of four, right? Age four, you know, we might have shared a popsicle or two in the, you know, during that time. But anyways, we were hanging out at their house one day and stuff, and we were playing hide and go seek, and we happened to hide in the same exact spot. And I'm saying happened to hide because it was planned. But anyways, we hid under the bed, and I had said, you know, I feel like kissing. And that's how I had my first kiss with Cleo. It was good, y'all. It was good.
And this happened when you were four?
Four.
And you remember this?
I remember it.
I can't remember where my keys are right now. Yeah, Miles, JR, either you remember. I'm going to go ahead and say I have no clue.
Princess was so, like, detailed. Like,
yeah, it was.
I might have been like four or five. I mean, you know, a cute little girl in like my pre-K class or something. I don't even remember.
I have no idea. I don't remember mine.
Yeah, I'm with JR on that one. So thank you, Prince, for this week's edition of Yinka's Random Question of the Pod. And JR, you mentioned that you're not having a good couple days, dog. Things been a little rough for you. I know that you are our team king. You know, you and Rihanna got the group message going on, talking about what's going on with these finals here and stuff. And I need to get your take. What's going on? What are your thoughts on the finals? How are they going? The state of the league? The complaining we seeing on Twitter? Where you at with everything, man?
You know, I thought the Cavs would come out and play a little better in game two. Game one, it kind of was what I expected. I expected the Warriors to win, but I expected the Cavs to answer their intensity and come and steal one at Oracle. I thought if they went back home 1-1, I thought they would be in good shape. But going down 2-0 and, you know, the Warriors have dominated. So it's been lopsided to this point. And, you know, everybody keeps saying, oh, the Cavs were down 2-0 last year. But Kevin Durant, man, he just looks like a different animal this year. And, you know, it's not Harrison Barnes going 5-for-32 anymore. They've added Kevin Durant, and he's just a totally different X factor to this whole equation. So do I think they can win game three? Yes. Do I think they will? No. Just because of how they looked at this point, Kyrie has been non-existent. Tristan Thompson is a victim of the Kardashian curse.
Stealing money.
The $82 million man has just looked horrible. I believe he's got 8 rebounds to this point, and we know that's his role, and what he does is get rebounds, and he hasn't done that to this point. J.R. Smith might as well stay at the team hotel. And Darren Williams is just shaming Team Light Skin right now. So,
hey, he's not with us though. they're about to trade him for an oxygen tank for LeBron. Y'all see that tweet? Clowning everything.
Miles, you got some salt to pour in the wound for JR. I know you've been over here. We've been giving him a bit of the business on the in the group message. Yeah, where you at with things?
I mean, there ain't much else to say. The first half was pretty good game. First part of the game. I mean, just a couple of mistakes though Cleveland made in the second half, and it was over. That was the crazy part. Like one or two mistakes. Cleveland can't make mistakes against this Golden State team, otherwise it's over. And they just pulled away. And I mean, how do you guard Curry and KD? You can't really do it. I mean, and they're trying to make LeBron play the whole game, but he can't do that either. I mean, he almost has to, but he can't, like, physically. So
yeah, and it's not like they can hide LeBron anymore. Right. Like, LeBron is out there trying to guard KD because he's the only person on the team who has a shot.
But he
and then he's got to go down and be the whole offense on the other end, too. Like, it's just too much. It's too much for one man. But, JR, you said a little something there. And it almost sounded complimentary of a player that you've been pretty hard on
second
in
play.
These Twitter streets. You know, like Kevin Durant has been the target of many a JR Twitter hit piece. How you feeling about the way KD stepped up? Because, like you said, it looks like a different beast out there thus far in these finals. Where are you at with KD and what you've seen from him?
You know, I've always been hard on players. I'm not a guy that's quick to crown players. I was like that with LeBron James when he first came in the league. And, you know, he kept finishing second and he didn't seal the deal whenever he got his chance. And, you know, he proved me wrong in Miami. So Kevin Durant was now my next target. And I've used second place as his nickname for a while because he was drafted second. He's arguably the second best player in the league. So everything he's done, he's been a second place finisher besides being an NBA MVP. So, but he still hasn't won yet, guys. He's still, I mean, they're up 2-0, but they're looking good, but he hasn't sealed the deal yet. And we seen this last year. He was up 3-1 and he didn't seal the deal. He ended up going 10 for 31 in back-to-back games shooting wise. So, he's still a second-place finisher right now. He's not a champion yet, so it's looking good for him right now, but he still hasn't shaped that name until he's officially crowned the champion. But it's looking really good for the Warriors right now. But right now, he's still Kevin's second-place Durant to me.
And one of the things that I saw today that was crazy is they said that through these first two games, Durant has already scored more points than Harrison Barnes scored in the entire seven-game series last year, which just seems impossible.
It's crazy.
Yanka, you been watching, man?
Yes, sir.
You got any takes?
Something that I kind of missed a little bit of the first half of game two. But something that I didn't notice is, you know, Miles had already said it, is LeBron just looks tired. He's guarding, you know, he's guarding Curry. He's trying to guard KD. I think what the Warriors need to do moving forward, and this is just my take, is as much as I love Bron coming out with high intensity in the first half, I think we need to see that more so on the back end when they need it. Because when Bron's done and Kyrie's not hitting, are they going to rely on Tristan Thompson? Is he going to hit? You know, is Kevin Love going to have a streak where he can pull them out? You know, Kevin Love could maybe give you, you know, a game where he gives you 30, but
he did yesterday.
I know.
Yeah, that's the
I know, but that's the thing. That's the thing is Kevin Love has to give you 30 while LeBron is on the entire game for them to have any sort of chance. I mean, you're facing four guys where, I mean, it was hard enough, in my opinion, it was hard enough to beat them last year with Curry, with Klay Thompson, and with Draymond Green. And Iguodala, on top of having to add in the behemoth that is Kevin Durant, who seems to be hidden from the perimeter, he seems to be inside the arc, and he's working the paint. I mean, Bron can't guard him the entire time. So I guess my take is, I don't know, maybe rest Bron more in the first half and see what he can bring to the table in the second half, because the game looked really good in the first half. It got very ugly very fast in the second half, and I think that's going to be continued pattern. Now, do I think that the Golden State Warriors can keep up this high intensity every game? No. And I think that's something that maybe the Cavaliers can take advantage of. But you know, I had already said I'm thinking that Golden State is still going to win regardless. But
I just want to jump in real quick, too, about this, the whole thing about just the LeBron aspect of it. Of everybody talks about LeBron, get LeBron help. He needs to get help. I mean, they've pretty much set him up for success in Cleveland at this point. I mean, he already had Kyrie. They traded for Love, you know, a few years ago. And then Tristan Thompson was supposed to be – I think he was supposed to be their, like, version of Draymond Green. He's not easily not even close to that, but I think that's what they envisioned. At this point, they've given LeBron a lot of pieces to, like, work with. But at the end of the day, these guys just aren't performing. They were performing early in the season, but they're just not doing it now. I don't think it's because – I mean, obviously they're not playing well, so that's a big aspect of it. But overall, I don't think it's because they haven't given LeBron enough talent around him. I just think Cleveland just played that much better to the point where they Golden State's played that much better where they just – you know, they're just making Cleveland just look bad on every level besides guys like LeBron and Kevin Love right now. I mean, so I don't know.
Terrified. Role players look terrified.
I honestly, like, don't know what else they could give LeBron at this point, though. I mean, obviously those guys just need to play better. That's a fact. But, like, in terms of what that roster is, I mean, they're beating any other team in the league, obviously. So that's just crazy part to me.
Yeah, JR, where are you at with that? Because, I mean, we joke a lot on, like, you know, you say a lot of jokes on Twitter about LeBron being, like, the GM of the Cavs. And I don't think it was last summer, but the summer before last, where, I mean, he got Tristan Thompson paid, he got JR paid. JR got more money than I think anyone else in the league was offering him at the time. But now it seems like they're kind of stuck. Like, what do you kind of, I guess first, to Miles' kind of point about LeBron having a team around him that's strong or strong enough or him having the help that he needs, I guess what's your thoughts on that? And then kind of second part of that is what do you see Cleveland doing in the offseason to try to maybe close the team gap between them and a Golden State?
I was fine with all the moves they made. It's just period point blank, these dudes not showing up. That's all it is to me. In the Eastern Conference Finals, they were fine making shots, and they were playing defense. But now it just seems like they're terrified, and we all know the Oracle Arena, it shell shocks a lot of guys that aren't used to playing there. And, you know, guys like Kyle Korver isn't used to playing there. Darren Williams isn't used to playing there. They just haven't been on the stage before. And you can tell because they just look intimidated when they're on the floor. But I'm really surprised at how poorly Tristan Thompson and Kyrie Irving have played to this point just because they've been in this situation before. They played in the Game 7 at Oracle. But, I mean, Golden State did a good job of protecting their home floor. Now it's up to the Cavs to – protect their home floor. It's going to be an uphill battle beating the Warriors 4 out of 5 times. Can it be done? Yes, it can. Do I believe it will be done? I don't, just because they don't have any confidence at this point, and there's no indicator that they will play better. But as far as a combination that they can put together to top the Warriors, I don't think there's a combination anybody in the league can put together to top the Warriors as far as offensively. But just because they have basically the two best shooters in the NBA, or three best shooters in the NBA, arguably, if you want to throw Klay Thompson as well in there. And then you have a guy like Draymond who plays his role perfectly as far as the energy guy and defensive enforcer. So they just have a lot of good guys that mesh well together. And, you know, guys like Steph Curry and KD, they don't have big egos as far as me first guys. And that's why I think the Warriors mesh so well.
Miles, Yinka, what you guys think? Do you think this is the continuation of a dynasty? Golden State about to be like the Bulls were in the 90s and the Lakers were in the early 2000s?
I mean, point, though, can they afford to pay all these guys?
Yeah, that's what I was going to
allude to. Curry hasn't been paid big yet. Who else? I think Klay got his. And
Draymond got paid, right? I think Draymond got.
I think so. Yeah. So, at what point do they – you know, can they afford all four guys? But I mean, you could potentially let a guy like Klay Thompson walk because of, you know, KD and Curry, but I don't know. I'm with JR though with what he's saying.
Well, I guess, how many more years do you think Durant is going to be kind of at the top of his game? It would be one question. And then I guess, Miles, you kind of already alluded to it is I do think, you know, we are looking at the Cavaliers, how dominant that they were at points where they had the team that was, you know, one of the teams to beat. But then you stack it up against a Golden State team with Curry and KD and, you know, Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, and you actually see how, like, inferior this team looks at times, you know, especially if you do this first two games. I don't think it's going to continue, but, you know, we had this thing where it was the big three, and now you're kind of starting to look at the league starting to transform into the big four. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Chris Paul goes somewhere. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, James Harden wants to move, or, you know, if Russell Westbrook wants to move and start, you know, just creating these super teams where it's way better for the league to just have four very, very good teams, kind of like soccer in the Premier League, versus having, you know, every team that at least has one stud on them that, you know, can somewhat compete.
Yeah, and Yanka, you brought up, I guess, the last basketball point we'll touch on before we get a little bit of football before we get our guest on tonight. Do you see a lot of angst on Twitter? Like, these playoffs are bad for the league and bad for the NBA, and, you know, seeing these teams and knowing since the start of the season that these two teams were going to be in the finals, it's bad for the league. I mean, ratings are up. So it doesn't really seem like that argument holds because people seem to be watching. But what are y'all's takes on that in terms of, you know, I guess the angst people are sharing on social media about too much dominance?
I'll chime in. I think that it starts with two kind of people. It starts with first the older generation who obviously grew up in the time of Larry Bird and Michael Jordan and how they can't seem to let go of some of these players who – you know, at the time that they were very dominant. But I mean, if you go back and watch those rosters, or go look at those rosters and go look at those teams, you know, they had maybe one or two superstars on there, and every other player on there was kind of an average Joe type guy. We have rosters now where, again, Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson can all be on the floor at one time. Like, we haven't had that. We were not having that in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, you know. So you have guys who can dribble. You have guys who can shoot from the outside, inside the arc. You got guys who can take balls to the paint. I mean, you've seen what Kyrie is able to do night and night again. And that's how do you address it. I guess the first team is basketball in 2017 is just overall better. Better athletes. They can do a lot more talented, all that stuff. And then the second group of people to address, I guess I would say, is the people who I kind of call them the football people who try to translate over to basketball. They want their team to be in the playoffs. They want their team to stand a chance. And in basketball, that's not so much the case at all. It's the teams that are the best, the Alabamas of basketball, which is what you're seeing as far as Golden State Warrior and Cleveland. Like, those are, you know, they're Alabama, you know, and it's just not as realistic to see our squad, you know, whether it be Minnesota or whether it be another squad, they just can't compete with Golden State. Imagine if Minnesota was up against Golden State. That'd be they would win in three because that's how badly that they would beat Minnesota. Right?
Miles Jr., what y'all think, man?
Can you repeat the question?
Just is it bad for the league that, you know, these teams are so damn good?
No. I mean, like he had Prince had pointed to earlier, like in the 90s with Jordan. I mean, Jordan won three in a row twice. I mean, LeBron's been in the finals 8 straight years. I mean, people aren't complaining that LeBron's going to the finals 8 straight years. It's I don't know. It's good for the league. You have the best players playing against each other. Like, it's pretty much just LeBron against whatever team in the West comes out. Now the last few years turned into Golden State. So, I mean, you got the best players playing against each other. So I like it. I mean, at the end of the day, you want to see the two best teams play against each other head to head to win it all, and that's what you're seeing. Year in and year out. So
how about you, JR?
I think it's kind of a little mixture of both. We've seen this before with Michael Jordan and the Utah Jazz playing in back-to-back finals in 96 and 97, I believe it was, or 97, 98, one of those. So we've seen dominance like this before from teams back in the 80s and the 90s, but the Warriors are kind of a rare occurrence of building through the draft and then adding that final piece in free agency, which you saw a lot of times in the 80s and 90s. A lot of big threes were formed through the draft. So that's kind of why the older crowd is kind of upset with what LeBron and Kevin Durant did, just because those teams were strictly built through the draft, which the Warriors have done, but they've added the final piece in Kevin Durant. But now it kind of gives those old heads something to talk about, because these teams are not really being built through the draft now. Everybody and all these superstars are just teaming up. So it's not a lot of parity in the league right now, and that's like their kind of cop-out for being able to argue about something. So I think it's good for the league, in my personal opinion, and ratings will stay up just because people will want to see. As long as the Cavs and Warriors are in the finals, they're going to want to see.
And just the last thing I'll say is that for as stacked as we keep saying that these finals are, I was listening to NBA radio on XM the other day, and Justin Termini made a reference to the 84 finals, and those finals had 9 Hall of Famers in them between the Celtics and the Lakers, which was just crazy to me. I mean, this is the most talented teams most of us have seen in recent years, but the fact that there were 9 Hall of Fame players playing in the same final series back in 84, that was that's probably more. We just don't remember it because
More too. Because on the obviously you got LeBron, KD, Curry, and then those are the three shoe-ins, and then Kyrie's in there. You know, he's getting to that point. Kevin Love probably getting to that point. I mean, you're shooting maybe 7 tops if Draymond and Klay. If you're putting those guys in there too, but they're kind of on that like fringe still to me. So it's not quite there.
Yeah, man.
That's a really good point.
Well, let's do this this really terrible transition now from the NBA Finals into a topic that JR actually brought to our attention a couple of days back. The Purple Podcast, a friend of the show, Matt Collar, Judd Zulligan, and Ben Gessling. And they were talking about the Sam and Teddy contract situation and different options that the team has and different ways that they might approach things with the contract. And they made some really, really interesting points, you know, on that podcast. And I know we've started to have conversations about this, and there have been, you know, maybe some back and forth on Twitter with folks about kind of what should be done and who should be signed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it was an interesting topic, and figured get y'all's takes on it. So JR, you turned us on to the pod. What were your takes on kind of what they were talking about in terms of how the Vikings might and how they should handle the contract situations at the quarterback position?
Yeah, so for those that didn't know, it was a podcast by Judd Zulligan and Matthew Collar, like Jason mentioned. I think it came out last week, I believe, around that time. And, you know, it was so good I had to go back and listen to it twice just to make sure I got every idea that they mentioned. So the thing that I loved about the whole podcast was that they said the decision should be made based on 2 separate decisions. And I completely agree with that. So basically what they were saying is let Sam play out his final year of his contract. Let that be a decision, and let Teddy's health be a deciding factor as well. So that's what I really liked about the whole thing. I think Sam's performance shouldn't be predicated on Teddy, and I don't think Teddy's health should be predicated on Sam. Let it split it up into 2 different decisions. So basically let Sam play out his final year of his contract. And what they were saying is the worst thing that can happen is, let's say the Vikings go 10-6 and they're a wild card team, and Sam repeats his success that he had last season. Then what do you do? In my opinion, I think you should franchise tag Sam Bradford. Just because I don't think he's a guy that you should commit to long term. Just because, let's say he does have a repeat success of last season and this upcoming season, that would be 2 back-to-back outlier seasons. So he's a guy I don't think you should commit to long term. Just because Teddy's younger and he's shown traits similar to Sam Bradford, and he's shown upside similar to Sam Bradford as well. So it's a touchy situation, and we really don't know which way it will go. But I think you should make it two separate decisions like those two guys mentioned in the podcast.
Yinka Miles, what do you guys think about, I guess, not necessarily the podcast specifically, but, you know, if it were up to you, how you would go about handling that situation? Like, what is the optimal way you guys see for us to handle the Teddy Sam contracts?
This is where it's obviously a very tough decision. Something that I have to, you know, bring up as far as everything is, do we feel like both Teddy and Sam, where they're at, or where we think that they can be, are they good enough, or are they going to become good enough where we could potentially risk losing maybe a defensive weapon in order to keep them around? Because, I mean, I think the what we see as far as Vikings fans or just the organization and stuff is that we finally got a level of stability with the quarterback position, and now we are struggling on both sides of the fences to keep one or both of these guys, because they both do give us at least average play. And I think we, you know, with the right amount of weapons and protection and stuff, we could see above average play to them. So, I mean, given that, you know, obviously you have to extend Xavier Rhodes, you have Anthony Barr, you have Trey Waynes, you have Eric Kendricks that you have to start thinking about in the future. You know, or even Everson Griffin, maybe even Linval Joseph. Is this, are these two quarterbacks someone we feel as if we could potentially lose one of those guys because the level of play we're going to get from either Sam or Teddy is going to be worth it? If that's the case, then now what you have to think about is paying somewhat of a premium, whether it be next year or 2018, to keep both of these quarterbacks, and then obviously let the best one win, and you just let the other one go, whether it be, you know, trading them or, you know, just letting them go off, cutting them, whatever the case is. I guess that's one way that I thought about it as far as, you know, how good are these quarterbacks right now? I don't think any of them have shown that they are worth giving up, like an Xavier Rhodes, for instance, you know, if you had to not pay him. I don't think he's worth, they might both be worth, you know, maybe letting Anthony Barr go, or maybe Everson Griffin. I don't think so much Everson or Linval Joseph. So I guess that's my mentality going into it. Are these two the kind of quarterbacks that you would be willing to lose a piece in order to keep them around?
Miles, I guess, what do you think about the question that Prince brought up in terms of, you know, how good Sam or Teddy are, and how that would affect how you made decisions in terms of,
how you dealt with
that decision?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think overall, I mean, I understand the keep the two situations separate because they kind of should be in terms of, you know, what Sam does compared to what Teddy does, because they're two different players. They're coming from different angles. Sam's going to be actually playing at least for the first part of the season. I mean, we don't know about Teddy. I do feel like he's a lot farther off. I mean, I know he's been kind of a bit practicing with the team, but that's just more rehab than it is him actually practicing. It's just a stage of his rehab. But I think personally, the tolling situation with Teddy's contract is the single most important part of this whole scenario, in my opinion, because if somehow he doesn't stand a pup for the first 6 weeks of the season, you know, he miraculously comes back, you know, by the end of training camp or, you know, earlier in the season than we kind of expected, then where do you go from there? Because both are in contract situations. You can't franchise both players. And at that point, Teddy's still going to be fairly unproven in terms of what his knee's doing. So to me, I think the tolling aspect of Teddy's contract, if they can get him through somehow and toll his contract into 2018, I'm not worried, because at that point, I'm basically just franchising Sam. I'm not giving Sam a long-term contract. I don't care how well he'd have to win the Super Bowl or at least get to like the NFC Championship game for me, kind of in that potentially the divisional round, but for sure like the NFC Championship Super Bowl range for me to be like, all right, we'll give that guy that, you know, that big money. Otherwise, you know, I'm not in favor of, if we make it to the wild card, giving him the long-term contract. You know, somehow we get the first round bye. I'd still consider that being like being the wild card just because you had that free first round. I'm not in favor of giving him a long-term contract no matter what, unless he plays out of his mind, you know, the yards per attempt. We've talked about this 100 times, but his numbers don't go up. It's his efficiency that goes up, and that's the big thing for me about giving him a long-term contract. But I'm just in the fence of franchise him, told Teddy's contract out next season, because at the end of the day, I'd rather have both of them than neither. But if I had to choose between one or the other, then at that point, it's really tough to decide, because you just don't know with Teddy, and Sam's just kind of been that average quarterback. So, I'm in favor of kind of seeing what Teddy's total contract does before making a decision.
Yeah, but I think that I'm with Miles pretty much 100% on that, in terms of if I'm deciding what to do with the Vikings for 2017 and planning for the future. Teddy doesn't see the field this year. Teddy, his contract tolls.
Agreed.
He rehabs, he gets healthy, and there's no way that I would put him on the field, because there's really no situation I can see with Teddy getting on the field that's a really good situation. I mean, you've loaded up to go in with Sam, so either Sam's playing well and the team's doing well and you're putting Teddy at risk in like mop-up duty or something like that, which is a low upside situation, or the season's gone horribly off the rails and you're risking Teddy for a low probability of a dude coming off potentially career-ending injury trying to save a lost season. And I just don't see there being a lot of upside in that for Teddy or the team in that particular situation. I think that the upside play is toll the contract, see how Sam plays. If Sam plays exactly as he has, you know, over the past 4 years, which is right at around league average, I'm not giving him any money. I'm looking to get him out of there before we get to the draft in 2018, if possible. And you go with Teddy for cheap. You bring someone else in the draft, wherever it is that we happen to be drafting, and you move forward with the inexpensive quarterbacks and a beefed up Mike Zimmer defense, and you kind of see which one of those guys is going to be your guy. I think JR has mentioned a couple of times, it's looking anyway like next year's quarterback class is going to be a fairly stocked one. You know, let the draft fall to you. See if maybe, you know, a Lamar Jackson or someone falls down, because you know they're going to get picked apart during the draft season. And you have a competition going into 2018.
And just to, you know, piggyback off Miles' point, and, you know, Collar and Zoga mentioned this in their podcast as well. We all know the Vikings' identity has been basically the blueprint of the Seattle Seahawks. Let's beef up the defense. Let's have a strong running game, all while we have a quarterback on a cheap rookie deal. Contract gives you that exact situation. And, you know, in 2019, we have guys like a Diggs, a Kendricks, a Barr, and a Linval Joseph, all are free agents. So let's say we let Bradford walk and Teddy's contract tolls. It gives you another year to re-up some of those guys before they're all free agents, and it gives you some more cap flexibility as well. So it's going to be an interesting situation, and I can't wait to see how it ends.
Yeah, I mean, it is somewhat interesting, because, I mean, a lot of what needs to happen for the Vikings, it really lies on this quarterback situation. And I think that's where this tug and pull of the debate with Sam and Teddy really comes from, because, you know, this is the first time since, what, maybe 09 or even, you know, Dante Culpepper that we've had some stability at the position. So that's where this kind of desperation of we need to have a guy locked into place to make sure we're not wasting this defense. We're not wasting the genius that is Mike Zimmer.
Well, I just did a quick scan of the potential quarterback free agents next year. Obviously, some of these guys might get long-term contracts before then. I mean, I'd assume like a Matthew Stafford is going to get he's going to get his contract extension before the season even starts. But you got Matthew Stafford's on that list, Kirk Cousins, Drew Brees. Those are the top names, and then obviously Teddy hits that list if he doesn't get told. And then Jimmy Garoppolo. Those are the biggest names out there. So I'm not saying some of these guys will end up becoming available, because I don't think they will. But if for some reason they are, the Vikings will have their options. And obviously Sam Bradford's on that list too. But The Vikings could potentially have their options to be able to throw the same kind of money that they'd throw at Sam long term to one of those other quarterbacks if they really wanted to. So,
is this Miles' hot take, Drew Brees to Minnesota? Oh my goodness, y'all heard it here first.
If this was, that was my dream. So, was that the year? I think 06, 05, 06. But if for some reason Teddy can't come back and here. It'd be the Brett Favre scenario all over again, but probably a little worse because Breeze doesn't throw like Brett. But
all right, well, I guess anyone have any final words on this? I think our guest is ready to go. So, Prince, you wanna finish off the segment with any fire, or are we good to go and see if we can get our guest from the website all the Vikings fans love to hate?
I don't think I answered your question fully. I think the Vikings should extend Teddy Bridgewater this offseason.
Friends. Of course.
Okay. Man. On mute.
We can't get into it.
No. All right. Well, hold on one second, y'all. I'm going to go ahead and see if we can get our guest on the line here. All right, well, we are back, and we have a special guest from the website Vikings Fans Love to Hate. We have Mr. Eric Eager on from Pro Football Focus. Eric, how you doing tonight, man?
Hey, guys.
And I guess, Eric, because you're an interesting case in that, you know, we have I was watching a conversation just the other day where someone tried to come at you and call you, you know, just a numbers geek who didn't know anything about football. But you actually have a pretty extensive football background. I guess, could you let us know a little bit about yourself before we get into some of the questions about PFF?
Yeah, so I am like a numbers geek, very much. I'm a math professor during the day, and then do PFF. It's kind of a hobby, and now it's kind of where I do my research in math. But prior to that, I did play tight end in college. I played for 4 years at a Division II school in Minnesota, Minnesota State. So I have some experience playing the game. I do come off as kind of a numbers nerd, but I have at least like blocked somebody before. So I think that's kind of like the misconception. And the really funny thing about it is almost everybody at Pro Football Focus is more of a football guy than me. I'm more of a numbers guy, and I played. So I think that's if I can sum up all the misconceptions of PFF in one, is that like we're all just a bunch of nerds with like pocket protectors who like barely know the game and just look at spreadsheets all day.
All right. Well, let's jump in. So there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, out there, and I think you just dispelled one of them in terms of what the folks who work at PFF are like. But can you help us understand, I guess, how does the process work? Where do the grades come from? I guess, can you walk us through a little bit of that and help us understand what it is you guys do and how you go about doing it?
Yeah, I mean, so I think what goes unseen is like just how many guys it takes to actually grade a game. So basically, for like a regular Sunday night or Thursday night game, we'll basically have one person doing the box score stuff. So actually like doing like, okay, you know, depth of target, where the person was first contacted, you know, what the play clock was at when, it, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then we have one person charting who's on the field and what they're doing. And then we have one person. And then we had a whole second group doing the same thing. And then afterwards it goes through a review process. So we have this like review process where there are any discrepancies, then we go in and we basically discuss them. And then later in the week, we do things like special teams analysis once all 22 is there. We chart out routes. We have basic, and then we send like the group of like plays that we're not completely not sure of to like a pro coaches network and everything like that. So I mean, like just what goes into that on a every single game that we've ever done has been like that. And it's, so it's a substantial undertaking. And then what's really cool about PFF is, like, over the years, as we've, I think, generated a little bit more credibility. So I think it first started with the Giants, who took, I think, like, the story came out that they were our first client, and then they won the Super Bowl that year in 2011. Since then, we've had more and more team clients, and those team clients have kind of guided how our process has evolved. So we certainly have graded things. We have certainly evolved the process from, like, 2000, and I think the first year that was live on the website was 2008. And then we've actually gone back and graded 2007 and 6. But, like, the evolution of the process is guided by what the teams, like, have given us in terms of feedback. So it's very much, I think, and I'm guilty of this. I think we come off, you know, I think some people think we're kind of smug and stuff, but I think we're very, like, I think that, we go out of our way to try to improve because we know that, like, we're never going to be perfect and we want to try to get more perfect. But I think that the constant evolution of the way that we grade and go about our processes is tantamount to that.
That's awesome. And I know that you just touched on something there that I know JR and Miles too, but I'll kick it to JR first, had some questions about in terms of how the grading works and how quickly the grades get up sometimes.
Yeah, so Eric, my biggest question was, without the all 22 film angle, how do you guys grade, like, secondaries as far as cornerbacks, receivers running downfield, and safeties, being that they're not in the true traditional camera angle that we see on TV?
Right. So that's one of the things that we, if it's something, well, so for one thing, there's normalization built into our grades. So if you are a wide receiver that's not targeted on a play, like, that's actually like a small negative kind of thing. That's, like, kind of mathematically how we build that in. So if you're, so I was just working on Chris Conley for the Chiefs, and, like, I watched the entire game of his against Denver, and he wasn't targeted the whole game until the very end. And, like, he's just going to get a small negative grade on each one of those plays because he's just not getting open. Now, that's not necessarily, again, a perfect system, but it's what, you know, with the all 22 and wanting to have the grades up when the game's going on, that's kind of the, you know, the issue. But then we do go back and we chart during the week what routes were run against what coverages. And so we do, it's sort of like our third. So I will be the first one to tell you that the grades that come up right when the game's over, you know, we say that, like, Trey Wayne's got an 85.3 or whatever. That may very well be not his grade once the grades are all said and done. And I think, you know, that's, again, one of those trade-offs that you have, you know, because we, you know, there are plenty of people that go back during the off season and they chart every play. And that's just because, you know, but for our purposes, it's sort of right away, we're trying to get this, our consumers, and trying to get the information to our team clients relatively quickly. So there are going to be errors that are, or I guess, like, just hidden biases in our data that we go back and do correct later with the all 22. But you're right, the all 22 is not available until, depends, but we get the special team stuff on Monday, but I think, like, Tuesday is when it comes out in NFL, the Game Pass or whatever. So yeah, that's certainly a fair criticism.
I guess I'll piggyback off that real quick. Nice to officially meet you, Eric. Always fun chatting with you on Twitter. My question to kind of follow up with what you're saying is it, would you rather be, so my, like, you're talking, some of it's not always that fully accurate. And then the idea is just to get it out, just push those grades out. Wouldn't the idea just to be a little bit more accurate and waiting than to get it up right away? Just in terms of, because some guys, you know, you're watching the game and you're like, that guy graded that well. How did he grade that well so quickly? You know, and based off of a limited amount of plays or a limited, you know, just different scenarios of different guys' plays and kind of what you're seeing, I guess, you know, sometimes when I watch Vikings games, especially, I'm more of a fan than I am like a critic. And then I'll go back and rewatch and kind of assess later. But just to kind of ask about, like, more the, when you rather be accurate later than in a sense.
The thing is with that is, though, you know, how many games per, or how many plays per game is a safety really doing something that's gradable and we can't see it on the camera? You see what I'm saying? So what we've seen is that safety play, for example, and corner play is tougher, but safety play, for example, the number of plays where he's actually getting a grade that's other than zero, you know, so most players get a zero grade on every play. And so, you know, and then we go back and correct if there's an issue. The number of gradable plays for a safety just isn't there. And the number of gradable plays where he doesn't end up in the camera, because again, like if he's beaten on a coverage deep, like that play is going to be replayed. You know what I'm saying? Right. And so we, you know, when I say error, I don't mean like a guy's grade goes from 84 to 76.
Yeah, right.
Review. I'm saying here's a perfect example. So take Thursday night against Dallas, right? Where Dez Bryant got behind the Vikings defense. And on that play, at least initially, it looked like Xavier Rhodes is the player that was responsible for Dez Bryant, right? And so if you just looked at the one live run of the play, coverage goes to Xavier Rhodes, his grade he's downgraded, and then, you know, subsequently we report that. But there was enough replay, there were enough replays of that play where you know that, like, oh, well, Harrison Smith should have gotten over the top. You know what I'm saying? So then, and then we have enough, like, kind of issues so that we can go back and ask, you know, what was this coverage in the all 22 and everything like that. And so usually I think what our standing thing to do is just to give out a zero grade instead of a plus or minus, and then go back, and we have tons of like note files and everything, and we just go back and check the plays that we're not sure of later. And so we're very conservative, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
like we don't rush to give a guy a really good grade or a really bad grade when we're not sure. We tend to go back. And so a bunch of zero grades, his grade might inflate or deflate, but it sort of regressed to the mean until we have more information, I guess. So
okay,
the errors are there. Yeah.
Right. No, that answered a lot of what I was just trying to get out of it. So appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Nice to meet you. It's been fun. It's finally fun to meet people in person, actually.
Oh, definitely. Well, virtually, but yeah.
So Eric, you said that you're a professor by day, and you know, with Pro Football Focus, you guys have your hands on a ton of data. I guess what kind of things are you working on right now, and is there anything, you know, exciting, or as Vikings fans, is there any of the stuff that you've seen or worked on recently that would be something that would be interesting to the fan base?
Yeah. So right now we're really trying to get some of the, you know, we've done a really good job, I think, of collecting data for a decade or so. Right now we're working on trying to have that data be more predictive, have that data be, you know, something actionable that we can give fans in terms of like a gambling product or in terms of a fantasy football product. Couple things like we've been working on is to try to predict quarterback play better is one of the things. And I know I sent you a file on kind of like how quarterbacks are distributed based upon the types of throws they make. So positively graded throws, negatively graded throws, and then doing some statistical things to try to look at like a quarterback's upside versus his floor, basically. And kind of looking at clusters and how quarterbacks, how quarterbacks group together. And so my favorite in that exploration, my favorite is Cam Newton and Jameis Winston, because those are two quarterbacks that they throw a lot of negatively graded passes, but they throw a lot of positively graded passes. And so, opinion, I think Jameis Winston is more likely to win a Super Bowl than somebody like Sam Bradford, who's in the category of a lot of negative or very few negatively graded throws and very few positively graded throws. Like he's, you know, steady Eddie. And from what I've seen historically, it's the guy that can string together a ton of really, really good throws, you know, like a Joe Flacco, who's kind of been bad most of the last, you know, half a decade, but he can have a really nice stretch because he's got those throws in him, you know. Jameis Winston has those throws in him. Cam Newton, we saw last year, has those throws in him. And that's kind of one of the things I've been trying to look at, is to see, like, you know, if our team clients want to know, okay, you know, what type of quarterback should we look for? You know, should we look for the Pat Mahomes in the draft because he's kind of more like a Jameis Winston, Cam Newton? There's a lot of bad, but there's also a correspondingly amount of good. Or should we look at somebody who's a little bit more like Sam Bradford or somebody like that? That's been one of the things. And then the other thing I've been trying to come up with, and we as a group have, is like a wins above replacement kind of metric where we can go and try to tell teams like how the, you know, how much is each draft pick worth? Because currently, like, teams are still really bad at doing trades in the draft. And it's because Jimmy Johnson's draft trade table from like the 1990s or late 80s is not that correct. And so that's one thing we want to be able to give our team clients. So we've been doing stuff like that, trying to come up with a good prediction model in terms of like picking games, you know, over under against the spread, all that kind of stuff, using our data plus some other things. Just being predictive with what we have, trying to leverage, you know, the very grainy data that we have, and just like, I don't know, just do well by our consumers. You know, you guys do such a good job of like, you know, giving us our motivation because you guys consume our stuff very well, you know, so we want to, you know, give you guys great products back, you know.
So you brought something up because before you came on, we were talking about, you know, the looming contract situation that the Vikings are facing with, you know, Teddy and Sam and how they should go about that. And just based on what you're seeing there in terms of, you know, the type of quarterback, you know, Sam is, or even Teddy is, because one of the things that I thought was funny with all of the kind of fighting on both sides of Sam and Teddy is how closely clustered they were as quarterbacks in terms of negative throws and positively graded throws. But based on what you're seeing there, kind of how would you go about approaching, you know, that looming decision in terms of the contract, and what kind of money would you be comfortable paying either of those guys if their play stayed exactly as it is right now?
That's a really good question because it is like when I did that study, I was, cause I'm very much in team Teddy because I'm to the point like, and this is kind of sad. Like I'll try to go back and watch a 2015 game and it makes me sad. Like I can't even watch Teddy play because it just makes me sad. So I don't know. Bradford had a pretty good year last year, all things considered. But it's kind of weird because at the same time, like he was only pressured. He was only pressured on 33% of snaps. So, you know, and he got rid of the ball so fast, it was like 2.45 seconds that it kind of mitigated a lot of those things. As you saw, he's the king of passes between 1 and 5 yards, right? It's like about 50% of his throws were between 1 and 5 yards. With Teddy, like differences in positively and negatively graded throws could have been due to kind of the offense that he was running, especially in 2015, where he, you know, was just not going down the field because I just don't think that was something that they really wanted to do. I think his offensive line was like almost as bad that year. It's just that Teddy had that kind of ability to move around in the pocket. I mean, he held the ball on average a full half a second longer per throw than Bradford did in 2016. So if I'm the Vikings, I hope for Bridgewater, but at the same time, to be real, I think you have to go into this season with every intent for Bradford to start 16 games. I don't think that you commit to him until the reason you've won the first 8 of 11 games or the first 11 of 16 games or something like that. I think, you know, and I think if Teddy Bridgewater's healthy and Bradford isn't playing well, I think you give Bradford the hook and you go with Teddy. But, and then furthermore, I think what we're learning in the draft process is that the smart teams are not drafting quarterbacks just to draft quarterbacks, you know. They're letting teams like the Bears draft quarterbacks when they're not that good. You know what I'm saying? And so I think that the protocol for the Vikings should be until you either find the quarterback in the draft that you really want, or you're convinced that Sam or Teddy is the guy, you franchise the better of the two until that'd be my opinion. And that's just because the quarterback market is so saturated salary-wise now that the top five, you know, the distribution of quarterback salaries is, you know, if a guy's any good to begin with, he's already making in the, what, 20s already. So Kirk Cousins' franchise tag looks bad, but it's not that bad compared to, you know, paying Nick Foles that much or something like that, you know. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it was in line with a lot of what was said by us earlier. So I guess maybe we know a little bit of what we're talking about. It's the last thing that I wanted to touch on with you here, because you posted a kind of interesting defensive formation on Twitter that sparked a full day plus of conversation in terms of what the Vikings should be doing with all the players that they have. And I wanted to get into that a little bit with you in terms of, with the pieces that we have and with the grades that the guys get based on what they do well, what are some of the ideas or some of the things you want to see us do on defense that maybe we haven't done in the past, or we haven't seen as much of in past years with Zimmer?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I was talking to Matthew Kopp a few weeks ago, and we were really interested in, like, what happened to Anthony Barr. I mean, like, I think this whole thing, Anthony Barr, right? Because if Anthony Barr is, or not Ray, if he's a Vontaze Burfict type of linebacker, Vikings really don't have anything to worry about. If he's Carlos Dunlap trying to play Vontaze Burfict's position, have what they had last year, which is a guy who's very inconsequential in the running game and very out of position when the other team passes the ball. And the way that I saw it is I looked at, like, our player participation data, and what ended up happening was sometime during the mid, like, when they realized that Sharif Floyd was not going to play, putting Brian Robinson in the double A gap blitz position, right? So they were basically doing three down linemen defensively, and then they were doing the center standing up, and Anthony Barr playing off the ball. And if he blitzed, he was blitzing from off the ball. And he subsequently was about half as efficient rushing the passer. And so I looked back at 2015, when he was the most efficient outside linebacker off the ball rushing. Most of his rushes were for a yard and a half of the line of scrimmage, so either in the double A gap or off the edge. And so that's clearly when he's the most effective. And I think other teams figured out that the Vikings kind of got gun shy with having him. I think that the Howard play in Chicago and the Theo Riddick play at home against Detroit kind of had them gun shy about doing that. The Vikings last 8 games, Anthony Barr is playing like a traditional inside linebacker in the nickel. Very inconsequential there. So I think if that's the kind of play, and you know, if that's the kind of player that Anthony Barr is, if he's more of a Carlos Dunlap that has Burfict, then he should be playing an edge position in the Vikings defense, at least on third down. Then we get to kind of like what is like the modern day NFL. And I look at Kansas City. You know, Kansas City is one of those teams where play dime defense 45% of the time. And they give up some, you know, their top 5 points against seems like every year. And it's not because they can still stop the run with that dime defense. They can't. They give up time. It's just that running is, even a team that runs for 5 yards a carry on you, or 6 yards per attempt throwing the ball in his Vikings days. You know, so even if you're giving up run, you're still on a play for play basis doing okay. So I think having the Vikings kind of go smaller on defense. And so my idea was to have Harrison Smith kind of play in the box in sort of a Deion Buchanan, Sua Cravens type role. Terrence Newman playing safety, you know, along with Andrew Sandejo. And then again, the crux of the whole thing is whether or not Trey Waynes and Mackenzie Alexander can step up and play corner for the Vikings. Waynes took a step forward last year. I still don't think he's quite there yet. He really liked coming out of Clemson, but he didn't really show much last year. So that's really where the articles of faith are coming in on that Vikings defense. He would make a fantastic safety in sub packages. So I kind of threw him in there. And then, you know, Everson Griffin was a very effective inside rusher for the Vikings before Jared Allen left. And so I think he'd be similarly effective inside there. You know, the three games in since 1986 in the 3-4 defense, and that was Ted Cottrell in 2005. So if I'm the Vikings, I try to maybe change history a little bit and move more towards a 3-4 with Barr on the edge, and then kind of moving into like a 3-2-6 dime frequently. But that's just kind of my opinion. And it's just from kind of watching a lot of the teams around the league and the teams that are successful, the kind of things they give up. The Vikings could possibly and have a truly elite defense next year.
Well, and I'll chime in real quick. We were just talking about the like how deep the defense is for the Vikings and kind of this. I want the back end is like some of the talent they do have in the back end with guys like Terrence Newman, Harrison Smith, the guys that you can kind of interchange because Xavier Rhodes is going to stay kind of in that same area. I'd keep him in the same spot. I wouldn't move him around. But, you know, Harrison Smith and Terrence Newman are guys you can kind of move around and kind of put in different spots. Based off of kind of the defense that Zimmer's built in Minnesota, the 3-4 kind of does seem to fit more of what the skill set of the guys that we have compared to the 4-3, just because I'm not saying I don't know how I feel Danielle Hunter should be used. I think he's just going to wreak havoc no matter what. But is he better off being more the 3-4 outside linebacker, or is he better putting his hand in the dirt being the 4-3, the 4-3 DN? We don't know just because we mainly only know him as a 4-3 DN, but Anthony Barr is more that outside linebacker 3-4 than he is, you know, rushing the passer in that kind of Clay Matthews mold than in kind of the traditional linebacker that they tried to make him, kind of to your point of what you mentioned. So, I don't know. I just kind of want to chime in and just kind of make that mention just because I think that's a really good point that I don't think people have kind of really thought about or talked about besides, you know, you've obviously brought it up. But so I just think it's a really interesting point to like make note of.
Hey, JR, from your analysis, sorry to cut you off, Eric. When you've looked at kind of Danielle Hunter and the traits that he brings to the table, what are your thoughts on that in terms of, you know, us potentially using him in an outside linebacker type of role?
You say Anthony Barr, I could barely hear you.
Oh, sorry, Danielle Hunter.
I think he's more of a 4-3 defensive end. Can he stand up and do it? Yes, but I don't think he would be able to do it consistently as much. I think he's a guy that's better suited as a guy that can have his hand in the dirt just because it's a little different rushing from a two-point stance as opposed to a three-point stance. You can kind of get more explosion when you're in a three-point stance just because you can lunge and force more from like a down position. It's kind of hard to explain
rather than
in person. So you kind of can get more force and more power off the edge when you're coming from a three-point stance just because you have a bigger windup as opposed to standing up in a two-point stance and just getting force from your legs. So I think he's a guy that's fine playing in the 4-3 defensive end position, what he's doing right now. And, I mean, the guy played in, what, 57% of the team's defensive snaps last year, and he came, what, third in the league in sacks. So I think the sky's the limit for him. But a guy like Anthony Barr, I love the idea that you guys made of him being a third-down rusher just because, you know, he's done it in college. And I just think he's sort of out of position, I think, in the box as a linebacker. He just doesn't look comfortable doing it. He did his rookie year, but I think he got by more off of straight ability and teams having a lack of film on him. But now that teams have film on him and now that they see his deficiencies, it's kind of been exposed. We've said a lot about him potentially having a wrist injury, but we haven't heard anything about it. So at what point are we going to stop using that? Not necessarily as an excuse, but kind of a cop-out for him and just come out and say that he's playing out of position and that he's meant to be an edge rusher. That's what he was at UCLA. And I think we're getting to that point where I think we need to see him in that role on third downs and maybe potentially being an edge rusher full-time if he struggles again this year, just because maybe he's not meant to be a linebacker. Maybe he is meant to be an edge rusher.
One of the things to even double down on what you're saying, JR, is that Hunter was like one of the most efficient run stopping defensive ends in the NFL last year too. This to me is all about how Barr the defense, because I think if you guys remember when Hunter played as a rookie, he was mostly like a third down guy who was, you know, a situational, and they actually had him standing up on the left side. I think it was almost halfway into the season before he was even comfortable rushing, you know, and to me, it's not so much about base downs, you know, to me, it's about passing downs. Cause I actually don't have a problem with Barr playing a traditional linebacker. So think about like a Bruce Irvin when he played for Seattle. You know, Bruce Irvin was a guy who played a linebacker in base and played defensive end in nickel. 4-2-5. Like, I'm okay. I'm at peace with that too. To me, it's one of those things where if he's going to be one of the inside backers in a nickel, and, you know, one of the games that I thought was the most telling of the NFL season, if you go back to, I think, played Atlanta, and Denver was running a lot of some of those, you know, where the linebackers would be in the A gap, but their responsibilities were for the running backs if the running backs were to come out in the pattern instead of block. And that put, and Atlanta really exploited that, knowing that their running backs were too athletic for the linebackers to cover if not given a head start. And I think a lot of teams did that to Barr last year too, which was, I think, you know, particularly, again, like you said, JR, when you, once you have tape on a guy, you know how to exploit him. Anthony Barr is far less exploitable in sort of a edge rusher role, or if they want to stay with a 4-3 base, you know, even though they only play base about 30% of snaps, kind of more of a Bruce Irvin role where you're still playing outside linebacker, but you're playing edge in the nickel. I think he would be better off in Greenway's role anyway. And that's kind of like what, you know, they had in that kind of Gus Bradley-ish defense in Seattle for a while.
Well, that's awesome stuff there. I guess we are pretty much running up on time here. I guess, Eric, do you have anything, I guess, exciting that's coming down the pipeline that that the people should be aware of? Anything that that you want to promote before we wrap things up?
Well, you guys all follow me on Twitter, so that's really cool, and I'm glad that I got to interact with you guys, because you guys are fun to talk to and all that. So I guess for your listeners, I'm PFF _ Eric Eager. And, you know, just I think at Pro Football Focus, we're doing a lot of cool things now with kind of more daily articles, like charticles kind of thing with bullets instead of kind of the long form stuff that I like to write a little bit better. I like to write the long form stuff more. You know, the fans like it more, and you kind of are staying abreast with the breaking news and everything. We just have two products that are new, the PFF Elite and PFF Ultimate. And so I think getting back to sort of offering the fans enough of our data so that, you know, we, you know, our fans can be the best fans, you know, out there. So, yeah, I mean, just, yeah, I'm very excited for the season. It seems it's only June, so we still have 2 months until preseason even. So just kind of looking forward to on any little Vikings news that comes across the pipeline on a daily basis. And just, yeah, just interacting with Vikings fans, you know, and no matter what these people in Wisconsin say,
I think we might have lost Eric's audio there for the last little piece. Eric, you still there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost your audio on the last piece. It sounded like you were about to say some fun things about Wisconsin. We definitely don't want to miss that.
Yeah. Well, so I live in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and I was about to say that, you know, here we are really good fans.
I would agree with that. Yes, Miles, Yinka, JR, any final words for Eric?
No, man, thanks for everything. And, you know, you were great.
Yeah, appreciate having you on. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Eric, all the stuff that you provide, I mean, you're a huge database for things that we can start looking into and reading about. And we very much appreciate you being on the show.
Prince is a little preoccupied, so I.
Yeah, for those of you listening, which you can't really see, obviously,
I've been making moves.
On a whole journey while we were recording right there. You know, went out, got in the car, went to his boy's house. I think he picked up some food, came back home.
Delivering pizzas.
You gotta get it, you gotta pay for that new computer.
That's a couch.
Yeah, Yinka was out there. I think he picked up affairs, an Uber driver, dropped off a pizza, and he might be home. I don't know. He might be at somebody else's house.
Listeners need to understand. I just don't stop working. I'm just always on the move doing something. So, yeah.
That's the football people, man. Like, I'm telling you, most of us, yeah. How many hours of sleep do y'all get? Like, I don't get that much.
Sleep? 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 Come on now.
And you do that anymore. I just hack around with numbers. So, guys that watch film, I don't know, they have a special gene.
Yeah, Jason doesn't watch film either, so.
Jason's not a film watcher.
When the second baby came, the film had to go away and the spreadsheets had to become the thing, man.
burn your eyes, baby. Burn your eyes.
All right, well, I think that's going to be a wrap right now. Even though we're talking, the Migos are probably playing in the background. So I'd like to thank everyone for joining us on another episode of the Climbing the Pocket podcast. And we will be back soon.